People are laughing already. Hi, everybody. Good evening. My name is Susan, and I'm an alcoholic. Thank you, Anthony. And I would like to thank one of the great events of my sobriety, my daughter in love, for asking me to speak tonight. That's Raina. And I was fortunate enough to get married to her father about 12 years ago. And that's another great event that has come to pass for me and countless others. And I would like to also thank everybody who does service at this meeting. I would like to thank Doug for sticking to the time, and like he promised. And let's see, I just would like to thank Alcoholics Anonymous for my sobriety tonight. I'd like to thank all my friends who came out tonight that are here to support me and show me love and give me a little courage, because I haven't done this for many, 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 many years, and I'm not going to tell you I'm not nervous, because I am. But I gave it to God, and that's my higher power, and I think it'll be okay. If it isn't, next week somebody else will be up here telling their story, next month. So, and also I just would like to say that this is my story, and this is how I've lived my life since before I came to Alcoholics Anonymous and since I've been here. And my sobriety date is July 23rd. I'm starting to get a little shaky on that. July 23rd, 1981. So this summer I celebrated 42 years of sobriety. And I would like to say happy birthday to all the birthday people. And I'm glad everybody's here tonight. And I'd also like to thank I have a sponsor, and she just celebrated 44 years. She's here tonight, and we've been together since 1983, since the time many of you before you were born, probably. And my story, I don't know what else I've forgotten. I'm sure I would like to thank somebody who's going to make faces at me tonight, so that's the one to make me laugh, yeah. So, you know, my story with my alcoholism, I am an alcoholic. I have the disease of alcoholism. And the way I found out that this is a disease is because when I was about, I really don't remember how old I was. I'm going to say, when I was a teenager, we used to have in our family a kind of a nightly routine. I had two other sisters. One is dead. And we'd sit in this little booth in the kitchen. And for some reason, my father, who was squished into the corner, and my mother was kind of blocking his exit, my father would, for some reason, he would just go slam his fist down on the table, and he'd bolt out of there. And then my mother would say, "Well, how was your day, girls?" And so then we would all, each of us, perceive that in a different way. And I know that I thought that if I ate faster or talked less or talked more or whatever, that maybe he wouldn't do that, because it was very scary. And that went on for a long time, and I don't know how long. And then one night my mother got very serious, and she, after he did that, and it was a rage, he'd be in a rage. She'd say, "Girls, I have something very important to tell you. Your father has a disease. And that disease is called alcoholism. Your father is an alcoholic." And after that, I can remember things started changing in my house a little bit. My mother used to slam doors. He banged on the table and she slammed doors. And she would say, "I'm so resentful." And, maybe she'd cry or something. And when, it just seemed like a change happened. And all of a sudden, instead of slamming the doors, my mother would just go, "Let go, let God." And my mother had been exposed, and I guess she started going to the wonderful program of Al-Anon. And so I always say that I owe the beginnings of my sobriety to Al-Anon, because that's where the seed was planted. And my father was reaching the end of his disease. The progression of alcoholism, he was reaching the end, and that's when I started my drinking at around age 16. And, I think I always had it in the back of my mind, I looked at his drinking and compared my drinking, the beginning of my drinking, to the end of his, and there is no comparison. You know, the way I started out my drinking, I was, as Doug was talking about, I was having great fun, you know. And my father was falling down in his food, his face was. So what I will say that my dad eventually got sober. It took him about five years of trying. And when he died, he had 42 years, which is the time I have now, and he was 92 years old. So it's never too late to come to Alcoholics Anonymous, and, you know, it's just never too late. This program will be here if you don't get locked up or covered up, and we'll always be here. And that's from the Big Book. That's the story of the Big Book. I love that story. They say there's only one way for us alcoholics. We're either going to get sobered up, locked up, or covered up. And if you think about it, that's kind of the way it goes. So I'm one of the lucky ones who got here before that the other two alternatives happened. And so basically, you know, I'm the kind of alcoholic who, you know, I was a what they call a functioning alcoholic. I mean, I got my teacher's degree, I got my master's degree, I was teaching, I was doing very well. And I was married, because when I was 16, I started having deep, dark secrets, the values that I had. I was drinking, and alcohol was taking my values away. So I had those deep, dark secrets. But I went on, I became a teacher. I taught down in L.A., and everything was going great. But all of a sudden, you know, we talk about these bedevilments that we have in Chapter 4 of the Big Book. And I was starting to have these bedevilments in my life. The first marriage ended. I immediately got involved with somebody else, and that was a live together. And sometime around in that, I went against my values in that, because I wanted to be married and I wanted to have children. And I gave that up in that marriage because of my best thinking had other ideas. And I just stopped doing the things that I... You know, it was okay. It was rationalization. I had rationalizations and justifications, and alcohol fueled that. And so in that relationship, which was a 9-year relationship, I betrayed that man, and I started getting into lots of trouble. It was what we call pitiful, incomprehensible demoralization. I was having very bizarre behavior, doing very bizarre things that you wouldn't expect a school teacher to do. But I was that person, and I started taking it to the classroom. I'm not here to say I wouldn't be able to say this in front of the PTA, but you know, and I don't have to. It's just the way it was. I'm not, you know, and so my life was in such bad shape, and I got in trouble behind alcohol, and the man was ready. We lived in a town called Encino in the San Fernando Valley, and I was, you know, it was all behind him. He's the one that, he became a millionaire in that relationship, and so I played Encino is what I called it. And I loved living up there, you know, because I didn't have an identity of my own. You know, I was with whoever I was, that's who I was, or what kind of car they drove, or things like that. That's how what a low self-esteem I had. And meanwhile, in the classroom, you know, I was starting to take alcohol to the classroom because I had gotten to the stage of my alcoholism where in the morning I was starting to have the shakes. And, you know, I was aware of the 20 questions. And I remember there's one question on there where they ask, do you drink in the morning? Well, you know, I don't know about you, but, you know, of course I had to drink in the morning. I had the shakes. And it just made perfect sense. And so once I start drinking in the morning, I had to keep doing it. Once I got the bright idea that, you know, I'm going to take it back to school, because I taught kindergarten. I was a drunk kindergarten teacher. And but my kids were gone, you know, at that time. I wasn't drinking while they were there yet. And that got worse. But so I betrayed this man, as I was saying. You know, I was drinking in the classroom. When the kids were gone, and finally I couldn't stand the guilt and shame anymore. And you can smile, Kathleen. Thank you. I'm getting pretty serious here. So I told the man that I lived with what I had done, and he was ready to kick me out of Encino, and that to me was a fate worse than death, you know, because where would I go? And I lived on Royal Hills Drive too, just to impress you some more. Royal Hills Drive, up in the hills. So I had seen something in addition to the 20 questions. I think my Al-Anon mom must have planted them there where I could find them. But there was also a chart. It's called the Jelinek chart. And there was something on that chart where it shows what in the progression of alcoholism that something about having social problems or problems with your social life or something like that. And I made a connection. And so I told my dad, I called my dad and I said, how would you like to take me to my first AA meeting? And he didn't bat an eye. He said, okay, I want you to meet me at such and such. Well, it was down in Van Nuys. It was down the hill and it was in Van Nuys. And right away, because I had this snob thing going, I thought, oh, Van Nuys. So I went to Van Nuys, and I went to this meeting. And this is all I did when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous the first time. I clung to my dad. I hung on to him. I thought I was very special because I was Bob Shaw's daughter, and I thought he was like the president of AA or something. Because all the time, you know, in my drinking, I was very proud of the fact that my dad went to AA. And when I would be drinking with people, I would tell them, you know, I think you need to go to AA. And here is the finger that was pointed out, you know, that we do before we get here. And so, you know, all I did, I stayed here for 5 months. And all I did when I was here was my dad signed my first big book. He put in it Susan from Dad, and he put the first sobriety date that would have been with mine at 5/14/78. And that was it. He gave me that big book, and I went out right. That meeting had bumper stickers. They had a lot of good stuff. They had bumper stickers. So I got a bumper sticker. It said, Easy Does It. And I plastered it on my car right in front of the meeting. He said, honey, you know, I don't know if you want to do that right now. He might have known something that I didn't. But so I had the bumper sticker. I had the big book. I must have read a few things in there. But then, you know, I was going to those meetings, and these women would come up to me with these little scraps of paper. And here's my phone number, and they'd shove it to me. And I thought, they don't think I have any friends. I have friends. And I did still have friends left, you know. I still had my job. I still had my car. I had friends, and I lived in Encino. And so they gave me those phone numbers. I must have thrown them all away because I can't tell you. Of course I never called anybody. I didn't, you know, here I was this big AA know-it-all, and I didn't get anything out of coming to these meetings. I did go to meetings, you know, and I went with him. I met him there, and he kept trying to push me off on the women, and it didn't work because I didn't, you know, have anything to do with them. One time I was at a meeting, and a woman turned around, and she was actually older. She's probably younger than I am now, but she looked older. Well, she was then, but she turned around and she said, you're lucky you got here, honey, while you still have your looks. And I thought that was kind of odd too. But so what happened was I started getting some ideas. I'd hear things in the meetings. One thing I heard that I just loved and it made me laugh, and I start to identify a lot. This speaker from a podium like this, she said she hid her bottles. And I thought, oh, I didn't know anybody else did that. You know, I thought I was the only one. And not only did I hide my bottles, but I would have wine on the counter when I cooked, but vodka behind the recipe book. You know, that's how I drank. And I was very sneaky. I was really good at sneaky, which we could also call dishonesty. And so I got this idea. I heard in the meetings something about, well, if you could control and enjoy your drinking, our hats are off to you. You know, something from chapter 3. And that's it. I never tried to control my drinking. And so that's what I did. I had a half gallon of wine left in the refrigerator, and I took it back in Encino in the bedroom there, and I tried to drink just one, and I ended up drinking the whole half gallon. And I'm here to tell you, when we talk about the progression of alcoholism, it was true for me, because I was now sick for 5 days. And also, I had always thought maybe I wasn't an alcoholic because I didn't get hangovers. Well, that began a really bad period of alcoholism for me. So now I had to undo. I had to tell everybody I really wasn't an alcoholic. I told everybody, you know, everybody at my school knew, you know, the whole world knew I was an alcoholic. And the hardest person it was to tell was my father. So I told him, and he said, all he said, and this is step 12, right out of the book, he said, maybe you're not, honey. Maybe you're not. Maybe you can. Maybe you can control your drinking. And he never said another word. And that's the power of Alcoholics Anonymous. He had about 10 years of sobriety at that time. And what happened was next is that I got kicked out of Encino, of course, because I couldn't stop drinking, and I got worse, and I was a very unlovely creature. And so I was able, because I didn't lose my job, I had a second thing where I was getting royalties, so I had play money on the salary of a teacher. That's pretty good, to have like a big allowance. And so I was, asked to leave Encino and Royal Hills Drive, and I got sent down to Roscoe Boulevard, and that's also in Van Nuys. And so I ended up, but I bought a townhouse. I owned a townhouse when I got sober. So for the next almost 3 years, it wasn't quite 3 years, my life got worse. I did worse things. Every time I had added alcohol to my life, I had to drink it. I had to drink it. I could never do anything without drinking alcohol. So of course I had to keep taking it to the classroom. And I never got caught yet. And I think you know the definition of yet, you're eligible to. And I did not lose my job. I did not lose my house. I was only losing those things which were the most important, was my innermost self. So, it just went on like that. It was getting worse and worse and worse. Right toward the end, I woke up on my bathroom floor, and I believe that now that was a seizure. I came to on the bathroom floor, and I consider myself very, very lucky, because I've heard of people dying from seizures, and I did hit myself on, the house was a mess, and I hit myself on drawers going down. I had hematomas and everything. And by the grace of God, what happened, and I love the what happened part of everybody's story, because I believe that to be the most spiritual part of our stories. What happened for me was I was having a 20th reunion with my high school girls, and they were coming to my house, and I was having one stay at my house. And we all went to the beach the day before, and I was drunk the entire time up till midnight. And then the next morning, I woke up, and I had a house guest, and I came down the stairs, and I said out loud, and I believe God works through people, and I believe that person was in my house for that very reason. And I said, I can't do this anymore. And I can't tell you how many times I've heard you guys say the same thing happen to you. I can't do this anymore. And that woman that was at my house, her name was Susan. And I believe I took step one with her. I laid on the sofa until I was having a party that night, and all the gals were coming to my house. I laid on the sofa with it. Thank God I wasn't throwing my guts out in the toilet. I laid on there, we had an ice pack on my head, and I took step one with her. And she said, you know, those bruises all over your body are indicative of liver damage. And that also caught my attention. So we had the party at my house that night. This gal, her name was Susan, she said, she even made me go to the market and get the stuff. That was brutal. But I did. And the girls came to my house that night, and they were all drinking the case of champagne that was left after I drank half of it for the party. And I had a friend named Sally there from junior high, and I had 12-stepped her about 3 years earlier when I came to AA. And Sally was there that night. She had 1 year of sobriety. And she told the gal, she said, "Susan's not going to get sober." She said, "She should be in a meeting right now." And, I couldn't go to a meeting. I was having a party, you know. But we had the party. I called Alcoholics Anonymous. I called Valley Club. That was where I got sober. It was also in Van Nuys. And it was... and this is no offense to Van Nuys, please don't take it. It's all about me as far as what an absolute jerk I was. Because I just thought I was better than everybody, and I wasn't. I went to this, I called the Valley Club, and then I went to my reunion, and I had my name tag on, but no one could recognize me because even though I had been so popular in high school, I was so bloated and, you know, I was a mess. I did not look like that lady say. I did not look like I still had my looks when I came back. Nobody said that to me this time. So sometimes I say that to women who get here while they still have their looks. Because, you know, I was losing my looks. And I was, you know, about 37, 36. I was having to draw in with a brown eyeshadow stick my chin line. And my mother would come up, she said, "You've got dirt on you." You know, and all these kind of things I had to do to make myself look presentable. But, and I wasn't ever presentable when I was drinking. So I got to the Valley Club. It would have been day three of my sobriety. I went up there and all by myself, I did not call my father. I did not. And because I didn't think I could make it. And I walked up the stairs, and there was this beautiful woman, and she had white hair, and it was in a French twist. And she said, "Welcome. Would you like smoking or not smoking?" And it was the best thing anybody could have said to me because, you know, and she ushered me into the smoke-filled room and to the non-smoking table, and then all the others. It didn't matter. It was the best. I was home. I had come home. And I had gone into that club, and this gal named Judy Kay was behind the counter. You know, she ran the place, and I thought she did. And she said, "Do you have a big book?" And I said, "Yes, I got one in 1978. And she said, "Well, read it this time." Yeah. You know, one person was nice and one wasn't, but she was right. It didn't scare me away. And so that began my journey in this sobriety. And this sobriety has been the most wonderful thing that's ever happened in my life. Doug was talking about service. I heard you say service. I got commitments at all my meetings. I was secretary. I baked cookies. Of course, I got tired of that after a while. You could buy them, but I just wanted to do it so right. And then something happened to me on the fifth day of sobriety. And this to me is, I only know in looking back because this was the beginning of the coming down the stairs was the beginning of my spiritual experiences in Alcoholics Anonymous, but I was standing in my closet where all this stuff was piled on the floor, and I had hidden a bottle of champagne there because I knew I'd need to get to it when my house guest was there, and I'd forgotten about it, and so I got the obsession to drink again because I'm the kind of alcoholic that, you know, I get obsession to drink. I got to act on that obsession, and so I had that champagne bottle in between my legs, and I was really good at popping the cork. I lived alone, but I thought it was really important to not make a sound when you open your champagne, and so I knew how to do that very quietly. So I had it between my legs, and I was getting ready to pop it, and I had three thoughts that came to me, and the first thought was, who would know? That would have been old Susan thinking that, old dishonest Susan, who would know? Because I did that all the time. And the second thought was,
I would know. And the third thought was God would know. And I didn't drink a bottle of champagne. Now, I didn't realize the significance of that for many, many, many years. We were in a step study with step two, and it came to me. That was so profound. You might not think it's a big old white light experience or anything, but it doesn't matter what anybody thinks. It matters what I have come to believe. And that's how I did start to come to believe, you know, and the insanity of the obsession of the first drink was removed. And I did not know that at the time. I was so frightened that my first year of sobriety that I would drink again. You know, I had no way of knowing. How could I trust that? And so I was vigilant. I was super overly vigilant about, you know, if I went to your house and you had alcohol, I'd want you to lock it up. You know, I was real over dramatic about it. But, you know, it saved my life, I think. And when I look back on that and see that that's when God removed the obsession to drink for me, you know, I just thought, wow, that's such a miracle, because I could not stop drinking on my own. I had the phenomenon of craving. If I were to take a drink, I always got the phenomenon of craving. I always had to have another, and I couldn't predict my behavior. And then I believe, you know, if I'd been away from alcohol and hadn't had any, and I got the obsession, only God could have taken that away. And it's been true for me for all these years. So my sobriety has been a great, great, wonderful journey. Like we say, great events shall come to pass for you and others, countless others. My first couple of years of sobriety, I was, you know, just extremely involved. I got married, fell in love and got married before I had 2 years to a newcomer who happens to be in this room tonight with his wife. And I'm here to tell you the power of the program. That marriage ended after 14 years, and it was very devastating. It was very shattering. And I didn't know how I could live. You know, I didn't know how I could live. But I was able to pick myself up and walk back to the telephone and call a woman who I was very scared of, but who had gone through that. Somebody with the same experience, and I called her, and she helped me. All the women start helping me get through this. And I'd walk into a room of like this. I walked into a room where we had been, you know, very involved in everything together as a couple. And now I was walking on my own. And it was quite very scary. Because I was, you know, it's like they talk about in the 12 and 12, especially, being overly dependent on somebody. It's who I'd been all my life, somebody who was overly dependent. And not having to make decisions for myself and going along with and all that kind of thing. And so I'd walk into a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and you guys would say, okay, you have to be the secretary. We didn't have a vote. You're going to be the secretary. And it was a big speaker meeting. And I did what I had done, you know, participated in as a couple. Now I was learning how to do it alone. Because I was a very immature adolescent thinking alcoholic when I got here. And I grew a lot in all those years. This happened when I was almost 16 years of sobriety. And I knew that I was, at that time of my sobriety, before the end of the marriage came, I knew I was really worried because I didn't think I had anything in me to share at my 16th AA birthday. I didn't feel spiritually fit. I didn't feel, I was getting, pulling away from a lot of things that I used to do. But I never stopped coming to the program. And so, you know, the end of the marriage happened. And so that was the beginning of the next chapter of my life. And that was a period that would last 13 years. And I never would have thought it would have lasted 13 years, but it did. And it allowed me to become a mature woman of Alcoholics Anonymous with grace and dignity. And my sponsor she was my third sponsor. And so she and her husband had moved up here to Morro Bay, and they encouraged me along with another couple, Kathy and Stan, to move up here. And I was very fortunate when I retired. By the way, I got to be a sober teacher for many, many, many years, many more years than I was a drunk teacher. And so that was how I was able to make amends to that. Be the best Susan I could be, the Susan that God intended me to be, and use my gifts to the highest extent of my capability. And so moving up here has been a grand thing. You know, I was 13 years and very involved up here with all kinds of things. I've been in service my whole sobriety in various positions, and I'm still extremely involved today. I'm more involved today, I think, than I've ever been. Some of the highlights of my time as, you know, well, the best thing that's happening right now, I mentioned that I, you know, I found another person that came into my life. This time I didn't. I just let it happen. It was God's, plan, I think. And I saw this person and I said, well, look at the way he dresses. And he's the old surfer dude. And the women with wise, who were very wise in my life, said, don't worry about that. So it's been a great thing. And but what I want to tell you today as I end this talk, and thank you again. It's an honor and a privilege to do anything in Alcoholics Anonymous, because how else can I pay back something that you can't really put a price tag on? It's Alcoholics Anonymous has saved my life. And it's given me a life of purpose. It's given me a life of contentment. And it has taken away the obsession to drink, and can't get any better than that. But you know, when COVID started and everything, wasn't it wonderful how we just jumped into action and got a new modality to, you know, to carry the message and to live this way of life and not have to, well, for me, you know, my group, Early Risers, we were on Zoom right away. It wasn't for everybody, and I was sorry for that, because I know some people just couldn't take it. And I wondered all the time, where are they? And I hope they're still sober. But for me, Zoom really, really added a piece to my sobriety. And I still use Zoom today for a lot. During Zoom, during COVID, I start sponsoring people in a different way. I start sponsoring a woman that had a method for going through the big book in the 12 and 12. And I said, would you teach it to me? And she did. And we went through the big book in the 12 and 12 in order with all the steps. And for me as a teacher, it really works out well, because I have a schedule, and everybody, you know, all my sponsees, there's a page for everybody, and I can keep track of where everyone is. And it's the best plan I've ever had for my sharing this life with other people. But everybody's different. Every single woman that I'm graced and gifted with in my life have become friends, and very close indeed. And you know, the fact that I never had children, not only is Raina my daughter in love, and I acquired her when I married her father, but the women in my life are almost all about the age of a child I would have had. And so I just get the biggest kick out of that, because every time one of them leaves my house, or I end a Zoom session with them, or we get together for coffee or whatever, I just feel so excited inside and so happy. And this can go on. I can be 92 and still doing this. You know, I don't have to leave my house if I don't want to. And everybody who knows me knows that's what I love. Zoom gave me an excuse. So sponsoring women, carrying the message, passing it on is the greatest joy of my life, I think. And I just want to say thank you, Alcoholics Anonymous, for just making me a better person and somebody I don't have to say, I don't have to look down on anybody today, because we're all equal here. You know, nobody's better than anybody else in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I think that's an important, very important thing to know. So may I continue just to be a simple alcoholic, another bozo on the bus. And I hope you all wonderful holidays and happy sobriety. Thank you.